The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Doing Parshas Shoftim today, and we will, God willing, finish the Parsha. Really, the Parsha is very straightforward. It's one of the most straightforward Parshas, I think, around, and it speaks for itself, but even though it speaks for itself at the end of the whole outline of what's happening, I will bring in a certain philosophical dimension to fill in the gaps, I think. Okay, so it starts off with Shoftim v'shotrim titen lecha b'chol sharecha asher Hashem Elokecha noten lecha. Judges and policemen, right, people who execute the judgment and maintain the judgment, put at all your gates, meaning in all your cities that Hashem has given you, and they will judge the nation in justice. And they should not pervert justice. They should not give favor to one litigant over another, and they should not accept any bribery. Okay? Basic ideas. And righteousness, justice you shall pursue in order that you shall live on the land and inherit the land that Hashem has given you. Then he goes into something completely unrelated, apparently, which is do not plant an Asherah tree next to the altar of the Beis HaMikdash, right? We have the Beis HaMikdash, we have the Temple Mount, and then, of course, we have the altar, and we're not allowed to plant a tree, right? Now, in those days, the idol worshippers had a practice of planting a tree next to their altars. And according to some opinions, it was a special kind of tree. But whatever it is, they thought that the tree granted a certain honor to their altar. And so therefore, we, of course, to do contrary to them, we are not allowed to put that tree, a tree, in the Beis HaMikdash. Now, initially, the Torah is simply saying in the Beis HaMikdash itself. The rabbis extended that towards the total Temple Mount, which is very interesting that there are trees in Temple Mount, when you think of it. Because really there shouldn't be any trees, I guess, on Temple Mount, according to this. Okay. Now, just a loose relationship, just to satisfy your curiosity for the moment, until we get to the end of this outline. The Gemara says that anybody who appoints an unqualified judge, right, is as if planting an Asherah tree next to the altar. Okay? So therefore, it's clear that we will have to somehow understand what is the connection between this Asherah tree and an unqualified judge. Yeah.
What is Asherah? Is it just
a tree? It's some kind of tree. I mean, according to some of the commentators, it was a sacred tree. According to others that I saw, it didn't seem like a particular type of tree, but it was just simply some aesthetically beautiful tree that they put next to the altar. And when we start getting into the more philosophical dimension of it, I think we can then do it. Yeah, that was the Gemara in Tractate Sanhedrin, page 7. Okay, then it says, don't set up a matseva. A matseva is a smooth one rock, right? Which was a single block of stone that was usually erected in some kind of commemoration and was inaugurated with wine and oil that's poured upon it. And the truth is, this type of thing was done before, and was permissible before Matan Torah. Yaakov Avinu did that. I mean, Yaakov Avinu set up a mitzvah after his dream, right? And therefore, at one time, mitzvah was permissible, and now it's no longer permissible because the idol worshippers have adapted that in some form into their practices, and therefore we are not allowed to do that. Again, what does it have to do with the Parsha called Shoftim, judges, and what is it doing here? And then the Parsha tells us, do not bring a sacrifice that has a blemish, okay? Even though it might be a minor blemish, there are very specific rules as to what constitutes a blemish and therefore the particular animal unworthy for the sacrifice. Okay? Now we go back into what we would have expected, but still a little difficulty. The next passage deals with how does the court deal with an idolater? Right? What is the specific judicial process in capital punishment to an idol worshipper? And one of the interesting things that are brought down here, which is an interesting idea that for the moment we could get into a little bit, which is that, of course, everything had to have two witnesses. Anything a person did, they had to be warned. The person had to make some type of statement which affirmed that they knew they were warned, they knew this was wrong, and they're still going ahead and doing it, and these two witnesses witnessed that whole thing. And it's only in that way that you could really bring a person to court and ultimately get some kind of verdict of guilty and, of course, capital punishment. The interesting thing is that in the process of the capital punishment, which is called being stoned, which is something that people do very often, but not in the context of judgment. But anyways, in those days there was something called they would get stoned, they would stone the person. And the interesting thing is these two witnesses are the first ones to be part of that process. Not too encouraging if you want to be a good citizen. I mean, if you knew that to be a witness means that you go into court, and if your testimony is accepted, then you have the grand prize for being such a loyal citizen. You have the grand prize to be the first one right in there to be part of the capital punishment. Of course, it doesn't seem to be something that would encourage people. So why is it so? Well, one of the understandings that I think can be accepted is I think it's a basic idea in Judaism that if you see something, then even though you didn't do it, the fact that you saw it means that somehow it's telling you something too. Right? Even though you didn't do it. I mean, if you're walking down the street and you see two people fighting, so you say, they fight. But somehow, of course, we believe that whatever is happening on the stage of reality is a reflection of who we are and where we're at. And therefore, why is it that the two witnesses have to be there? Because somehow, because they are the witnesses for such a serious crime, they must have some element of it, or perhaps some danger towards it, and therefore they themselves must be part of the process of uprooting such a thing, so that it has an internal quality to it also. Okay, but that's it. You know, it just talks about how the court would conduct the process of justice upon an idol worshiper. And that's all. It doesn't go into anything else. And of course, why just that all of a sudden? Why single out just that judicial process? Okay. Then, of course, we have here the famous, one of the most important passages in terms of Judaism, in terms of one of the most basic concepts in Judaism, which is that we must obey the great Sanhedrin and the leaders, right? The Torah leaders. They have the authority to decide, and we must be according to their decision. Now, when we had a great Sanhedrin, the majority would rule, and whatever they would rule, that's what we would have to do. Right? And there are stories in the Gemara where the majority ruled, and one particular rabbi, the rule was this would be Yom Kippur. Another rabbi, according to his calculations, Yom Kippur would be another day. And he was commanded to come on the day that he calculated Yom Kippur to the court with his purse and his cane, so to speak, to desecrate Yom Kippur as he so perceives it. Right? Because he had to demonstrate that he completely is subservient to the rulings of the court. And it's a basic idea in Judaism, we have to have the trust in the rabbis. Now, of course, this becomes a little more difficult. Because then, is it this rabbi? Is it that rabbi? I mean, that's the problem of our generation, that we really do not have a uniform body of rabbis anymore. We don't have a Sanhedrin. They claim that the intended purpose of Heichal Shlomo, you know, the famous, the building on King George, just across from the plaza. That you know, right? You know where the plaza is, right? Okay, well, just across from the plaza, that landmark of Jewish holiness, is a place called Heichal Shlomo. And Heichal Shlomo, so I heard, was really built with the intention that it would house the Sanhedrin, right? And that's what really people were expecting to happen. We come back to the land of Israel, we set up a Sanhedrin, and apparently rumor has it that there actually is a room in there set up for 71, because the Sanhedrin was made up of 71. Anyways, we don't have a Sanhedrin, therefore it makes this... Hope that wasn't on tape. No, that's okay, that's airplanes. You can tell because of the aftermath. Right? If it was a bomb, you would tell because we wouldn't be here. But it's not. Just a side point. I mean, I would say the second day I was in Eretz Israel, I mean, you know, here I am, the land of Israel, and I was walking to the yeshiva that I would be at because our dormitory was a couple blocks away, and I heard that very sound. And I, of course, you're really nervous. If you just got to Israel, and of course, they're already bombing us, and couldn't they have done that the day before I came? Anyways, a guy says to me, oh, don't worry, those are just planes. That's planes. You don't have to worry about that. I said, oh, there's planes. Oh, that happens all the time. So, oh, great, wonderful. Anyway, so it was on the news that those were bombs. Those were actually bombs. And there was a terrorist attack in Jerusalem, and these two terrorists were actually going in the direction, and it seemed like they were going in the direction of a yeshiva, right? And the bomb exploded in their hand. So anyways, just But I still think that's a plane. Okay. So, anyways, they have to obey the rabbis. And it's a very, very strong statement. And of course, you know, if you want to be critical about it, I'm sure this is a great verse to get into. But in a very strong way, it says, and even if they tell you that the left is right and the right is left, you listen to them. And of course, it's a very powerful thing to say. And of course, a Bible critic would say, you see, this is the rabbis who wrote this to secure their position. And of course, we would not accept that. But of course, it just kind of begs that. So we have to listen to the leaders. We have to have a sense of trust in those leaders and the majority rules in that case. This itself is important because the whole chapter is talking about leadership. The whole chapter is talking about judges, priests, kings, and prophets. And these are our leaders. And that's what this whole chapter talks about. It delineates who they are and their responsibilities. That's what this is all about. Okay? And they must be leaders. Right? And the majority rules of those leaders, or whoever the leader is, the king, and the people must follow the leaders. And there's a Gemara, a very frightening Gemara, which we see today. I mean, I'm sure we saw it many years ago before, too. But even today, there's a Gemara that says there will come a time where the leaders will be like dogs. Right? The leaders will be like dogs. Now, what does that mean? Right? Well, one of the understandings that I heard, which I think is so appropriate, it's like a dog that kind of runs ahead of its master. And so from your perspective, it looks like the master is following the dog. Right? The master is following the dog, and the dog is leading the master. But the truth is that when the dog gets a kind of distant from his master, right, he consciously and consistently kind of like turns around to see which way his master is going. Just like children. I mean, children, they can run ahead, and they look like the leader, and look like the parents following the child, but the child always carefully looks back to see which way the parent is going, and really the parent is leading. And so too, in the future, there will be leaders that are similar to dogs, right? That they are not leading the people. They are letting the people lead them. They are more under the influence of the people's perceptions rather than their responsibility to do what is right to do, and rather than always playing into what do the people want to secure my position. Right? Sometime a leader must do something that, even though the people don't like it, the people will admire such a leader because they will realize their dedication. Okay, so we have to listen to the leader. And that then further continues, is continued in the Parsha by a law called Zaken Mamre, which is the punishment of a Torah sage. When we're talking about a person who knows Torah and decides a ruling against what the Sanhedrin has ruled, and it's specifically a ruling that, if transgressed, has the implications of karet, which is a particular punishment, being cut off. If they decide a decision halakhically against, in a situation, in a concern, or in a particular issue, which would incur that kind of punishment, then they could reach death penalty. It's that serious, right? Of course, you might have opinions. You might not agree with the rabbis, and you've got the right to your opinion. But you can't rule upon it and act upon it. Right? But, you know, you have your opinion. Okay. Then the Parsha continues to talk about the mitzvah to appoint a king. That when you get into the land of Israel, you will appoint a king. And the various laws accompanying what the king is to keep, and these are laws that would qualify him in terms of being a king. What are those laws? He is not allowed to have too many horses. Right? Unnecessary amount of horses. He is not allowed to marry too many women. Now, of course, you have to remember in those days, the practice was that a man was permissible to have more wives. And in those days, kings, I mean, you know, kings had hundreds of wives. And the Jewish king, within the context of that historical period, was limited to a certain amount of wives, no more than that. And they were not allowed to amass more wealth that's necessary for the maintenance of his army, okay? Meaning that he had to live in a manner that would curb any possibility of his position becoming an ego trip, right? An ego trip. But rather doing what has to be done and maintaining a kind of lifestyle that maintained a sense of respect. I mean, the king can't walk around like a schlepper either. But whatever royalty, right, whatever royalty that encompassed the king would only be for the purpose of maintaining the kind of respect and awe the people have for the king so that the king could properly serve the people, right? And that's important. A king must have kavod, and a king has the right to have, you know, his palace and his horses, but it still has to be limited to what is necessary to maintain the proper respect necessary for him to do what he has to do, which is to respect the people and to serve their needs. All right? Okay. Not only that, the king had to write his own Sefer Torah. Right? Now every person, or really, I think it's only an obligation of a man, but I'm not sure actually, has to write a Sefer Torah. Has to write a Sefer Torah. Now, in modern days, there are various opinions whether that is fulfilled by buying books. Modern opinions is that it's fulfilled by paying a sofer for the last lines. In terms of the halakhos, I'm not getting into it. But there is this consciousness that an individual should write a Sefer Torah. Right? The king has an added responsibility as a king to write a Sefer Torah. So he would have two Sefer Torahs. Right? And this Sefer Torah is a Sefer Torah that he would carry with him always. Listen, you have to picture what a Jewish king looked like. A Jewish king would have tefillin on his head, tefillin on his left arm, and an entire Sefer Torah bound to his right arm. Right? Now, of course, it would be a very small Sefer Torah, right? Which they exist. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen, but there are today even Sefer Torahs that are about this big. Big enough, small enough, that could be put into your pocket. Right? Mr. Keneal has one. Right, an authentic Sefer Torah that it, you know, the little handles can be unscrewed and stuffed in to make it even more compact, and it actually fits into your pocket. And that was, of course, because the Jews were always on the run, right? And therefore, they had their little, I mean, people thought that Walkmans were impressive. You should see the Sefer Torah, right? And they would have this little Sefer Torah that could just take off with the Sefer Torah. Well, anyways, the king would have a little Sefer Torah bound to his right arm. And this is what a Jewish king looks like.
He would wear his tefillin all the time?
Well, in those days, a man should have been wearing his tefillin all the time anyways. And even today, we should be. But because we're not able to maintain the specific laws, many don't. But there are certain rabbis that still do wear the tefillin all day long. But you have to understand, a Jewish king would wear, that would be his crown. Right? His crown would be his tefillin. Right? And it would be on his left arm, and he'd have his entire Sefer Torah. And he'd always have a Sefer Torah, because no matter where he would be going. Remember, what is the king doing? Right? He's showing up to various meetings, he's going to war, he's doing... But the Sefer Torah is right there. It's the soul of the national existence. Right? It's not just simply an interesting thing that accompanies national existence. It's the soul of national existence. And that itself is something that's really frightening, that all the leaders of present-day Israel aware of Judaism. Right? And they really should be taught Judaism, not because we're trying to macarve them. It wouldn't work. They feel it right away. But I do know, I had a certain teacher who told me that he was employed by, in those days, I think it was Rabin, who actually, he was teaching him Torah. Right? Because he understood that for me to be a leader of the people, I must know the Torah. Not that he's going to keep it necessarily, but at least he would know its principles, he would know the Jewish history. Anyways, now he would be responsible to read parts of Devarim once every 7 years, which is called the Vikahel ceremony, which we just had not too long ago, which is an amazing thing. And Herzog, President Herzog, actually, he's, it's unusual that you have a president who could read the Torah, but his father was a great rabbi. And he read the Torah, and thousands of people there. It was a very big ceremony not too long ago, a year or two ago. Okay, then it talks about how the Levites should have no portion in military spoil, no portion in land, because their portion is God. And of course, this is talking about the Kohanim as leaders. Okay, the Kohanim and their position as leaders. And now, it then begins to tell us about the prohibitions against taking consultation from various occult practices, which is, first of all, it starts off with the concept of passing kids through fire to Molech, which must have some kind of connection to soothsaying and futuristic and trying to get direction, I'm not sure what. Consulting the rod, which they would call Kosem, or other acts of divining the future. Declaring certain days lucky or unlucky is forbidden in Judaism. Going to someone who speculates on the future and tells you this certain thing is going to happen, which is why we are now allowed to go to an astrologist if you're talking about horoscopes. That's completely forbidden in Judaism. And there's a question whether using astrology for just understanding yourself is permissible. But in terms of using astrology for this day is lucky, this day is not lucky, completely forbidden. Horoscopes are forbidden in Judaism. There's all kinds of occult practices. They would bring up the dead. They even had a practice where they were able to emit a voice from their armpits. Right? I mean, you're talking about really weird stuff. And of course, it's all consulting various spirits so you can know what to do. Which people go to psychics and, you know, all kinds of things till today. And they seek direction from these people. They have something called a yiduni, which is this kind of bone called a yidua bone. And they put it underneath their tongue and it would begin to speak. And they have these things. They witness these things. Okay. Consulting skulls. Okay. And all this is brought down in the Parsha and it's forbidden again. This Parsha is about leadership. Who are our leaders and who are not our leaders? And certainly these are not the people that we should see leadership from in terms of how to direct our lives. And the Parsha here says, and you shall be pure in your walking with God. Person should rely on God and their relationship with God as their source of leadership through the representatives of Hashem, which will be the Sanhedrin, the king, the prophets, the priests. Okay. After the Torah has clarified the various positions, which is the Sanhedrin, the king, the priest, the prophet, after this whole prohibition against consulting these various occult people, it says, and you shall consult the prophet that God will set up in your time. And of course, there were various prophets throughout the history of Jewish people, which ended at the close of the Second Temple period. Okay. After we've established who are our leaders, then the Parsha continues on with various responsibilities of those leaders. The Sanhedrin are responsible. One of the examples of the Sanhedrin's responsibility and its extent of responsibility is that of the refuge cities that are set up for a person who has accidentally murdered somebody and therefore must run for refuge in the city away from the close relatives who could kill in avenging the blood of their close relative. And their responsibility, the Sanhedrin's responsibility, was to make sure that the road was always clear so that they would never have any responsibility in that person didn't make it there fast enough because the roads weren't clear. And their responsibility was that the signs how to get this way to refuge city were always very clear and always set up. Okay, so these are responsibilities of the Sanhedrin. Also the responsibility of properly maintaining borders. So it deals with that you're not allowed to take someone else's borders in terms of squeezing out somebody. You have land and this guy has land beside you and you push your fence either yard further as you squeeze this guy out. And so this is, of course, the responsibility of the Sanhedrin to maintain borders, which they themselves were part of setting up in the first place in the allocation of land. Then the Parsha talks about their responsibility in examining, properly examining the witnesses, because there are witnesses that come in and plot against people. Right? It moves then towards the responsibility of the king, dealing with how a Jewish army is organized, right? And how they would go to war. And a Jewish army is organized. And one of the major pieces brought down here is that before they would go to war, they would get up and say, is there anybody here who has built a house and has not yet had the opportunity to put their mezuzah on the house? If so, leave. Right? Is there anybody here who has planted a vineyard and or crops and has not had the, it's actually a vineyard, has not had the opportunity to eat of its fruit because it hasn't gone past the fourth year? Which is only you can only eat of the fruit after the fourth year. Is there anybody here who is betrothed and is not yet married? I mean, you're engaged and you haven't come to marriage yet. All those people are free and do not go to war. They would help in other ways, but they would not go to war. And anybody who is faint of heart at the sight of a sword, leave. Okay? One of the understandings is why these particular categories, one of the understandings is because these people would not be good soldiers. Because they'd always have in their minds, oh, my house, oh, my vineyard, oh, this girl. And they just certainly would not have the kind of clarity of purpose right now to be good soldiers, and therefore they're told to go. Okay? And then the last piece of this Parsha is one of the most difficult passages I think I've seen in the Chumash, which is called an Egel Arufa, which is they find a murdered person, a dead corpse, on a street outside the cities. And they don't know who did it. They don't know who did it. What do you do? Notify to, so there's an unidentified murder here. So they would go to the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin would send five representatives to visit the scene of the crime. Visit the scene of the crime. Then they would be responsible to measure from that dead corpse to the surrounding cities to see which city is the closest. Now, even if it's obvious which city is the closest, there is a mitzvah to measure the distance from the corpse to all the various surrounding cities. Because all the various surrounding cities must have a sense of connection to this crime. However, the closest city would then have to send its elders out to the scene of the crime, and they would take over now the process. They would have to bring a calf, which is 1 year old, that has never done any labor. Okay? And it would be purchased by the community funds. They would lead this calf to a valley which was rocky, hard soiled, and they would slaughter this calf. Okay? They would slaughter this calf, they would wash their hands and say, our hands were not on this murder. Right? That's what they would have to declare. That we have taken no part, our hands have not shed the blood, nor our eyes have seen this deed. Meaning what? That they have to feel a certain sense of responsibility to this person, and they have to say, even indirectly, we did not see this person, we don't know who he was, he wasn't in our community, and we didn't send him away without food, without accompaniment, into dangerous roads. Okay? Then the Kohen would then entreat Hashem, and pray, Hashem, please atone for Am Yisrael, don't hold us responsible for this innocent blood. Now, if they were tzaddikim, there's a very mystical thing brought down, that one of the opinions is that the Egel Arufa, before it would have been slaughtered, it would walk to where the murderer is. And they would find the murderer and they would not have to do the Egel Arufa. That's one opinion. Because if you find the murderer, you don't have to do this. You found the murderer. So one opinion is that in those days when they were really on a very high level, so then they would just watch this young calf, and this young calf would walk on its own and mysteriously find the murderer. If only we had that kind of a, you know, hounding cow that would seek out, you know. Anyways, another opinion is that they would have to slaughter the cow, and mysteriously worms would come out of this cow, and they would go towards and find, and they would follow these worms. All this is beyond comprehension. The point being is that the Sanhedrins, the elders, and the priest all must feel a personal sense of responsibility to a crime, although it is not being brought to them. Try and figure out a deeper understanding of the dynamics of this parsha and what it tells us about Jewish justice. Now, a very, very fascinating midrash that says that King Solomon made a special throne upon which to judge. And it had six stairs that you would climb to get to this. And there would be a herald, you know, that would be beside this chair, this throne. And when Shlomo would ascend and step on the first step, this herald would say, do not pervert judgment, which is the first mitzvah here of the judge in our parsha. When he would ascend the second stair, they would say, do not favor one litigant, which is the second law brought down in our parsha. Do not pervert judgment. Second one is, do not favor one litigant. Third one is, don't take bribe. So he would step on the third step and they would say this. When he would step on the fourth step, he would be told, do not plant an Asherah tree next to an altar. What does this have to do with judgment? When he would step on the fifth step, he would be told, do not create a matseva, this single blocked thing used for idolatry, because our altars were made of many stones. And when he would step on the sixth step, he would be told, do not sacrifice a blemished animal. All the first mitzvahs of this parsha. So therefore, from this midrash, of course, we must figure out what is the connection. What do the first three warnings, which are obviously connected to judgment, have to do with the last three warnings, which are obviously connected to service, to worship, to the base of Migdash, right, and its dynamics? So in a general sense, without getting into the specifics, in a general sense, there's no doubt that there must be a relationship between justice and avoda, service. Okay? And the question is, what is that relationship? There must be some relation between the Sanhedrin and the Migdash, which there was, because where did the Sanhedrin sit? In the Migdash. In the base of Migdash, there was a chamber for the Sanhedrin. Why must the Sanhedrin be convening in the base of Migdash? Right? What is the connection? Now, it all goes to understanding what is justice. How can we understand justice? Does justice exist before the existence of the world or after? That is the question. Right? That's a very serious question. How do I understand the nature of justice? Is justice a primordial divine attribute, which therefore is prior to creation, in fact the vehicle through which God created the world? Or is justice after the world? We wouldn't want to use creation at this point necessarily, because you wouldn't have to have a creation necessarily. It could be an eternal world. Does justice occur after existence of the world and is a human device for human survival? It's a very, very important question, right? Is justice of a primordial divine quality prior to the creation of the world the vehicle through which the world was created, or is justice after the world, right, not a vehicle for the creation of the world, but a vehicle for the maintenance of the world of human survival, a product of human perspective and perception? That's the question, right? Justice as a divine attribute, or justice as a human device? Justice as the vehicle towards the creation of the world and the recreation of the world, because the world is continually being created? Or justice as a device for the maintenance of the world and human survival? What is the significance of the two approaches, right? What is the implications of the two approaches? Well, it's very clear what the implication is. You see, if justice is a primordial divine attribute prior to the world, which the world is founded upon, then the world must answer to justice. Justice does not have to answer to the world, right? The world must serve justice. Justice does not have to serve the world. Now, of course, you can understand the difference, right? Because if justice is a human device for human survival, then it's just to, you know, let's face it, if all the mental institutes are draining the treasury of the state, well, then it's just to get rid of them, right? Because they are undermining human survival. You see that? And you have no right to say no if you don't believe in a God. Because in the name of human survival, right, in the name of the perpetuation of human needs as the human perceives, you can do almost anything in the name of justice, right? Right? You can have quite a perverted world. And therefore, that's the big question. Do you sacrifice justice for human survival, or do you sacrifice human survival for justice? Do people die for justice? Do people die in the name of justice? Why would you die in the name of justice if justice is something we came up with? Because it works. Right? It's a very, very deep question. Very, very deep question. And that question is further enhanced in terms of its implications, because what it then means is, who is a judge? Is a judge a servant of God, or is a judge a servant of man? Who is the judge accountable to? It's very heavy. The Gemara in Tractate Shabbat, page 11, says, "Kol dayan shidan emet la'amito." Any judge that judges truth according to its truth, the verse considers him as a partner in the creation of the world. Why? Because we believe that the world was created through justice, which is Torah, which is a primordial reality prior to creation, prior to a world. The world is founded upon justice and created through and recreated through justice. And when there is a misconception or a question, a dilemma of justice, so to a certain extent, that situation is in a state of tohu and vohu, right? Chaos before creation, right, so to speak. And the judge is like a god, a vehicle for creation of order. And therefore a judge in Jewish tradition is called an Elohim. Unbelievable. A judge is referred to as an Elohim, because a judge participates in a godly process of the creation of the world. Justice is the foundation of the world. The world is not the foundation of justice. The world is dependent upon justice. Justice is not dependent upon the world. Right? The world must serve justice, and justice does not serve the world. But you always have to remember, a world that serves justice is a justice that will truly serve the world. Right? That's the question. Right?
How do you stand for justice?
Justice? Tzedek. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. That's what this is all about. So you have to understand that there is a real serious connection between justice and avodah. Because the judge is like a kohen, and a court belongs in the Beis HaMikdash. Because the justice we're concerned with is God's justice. A primordial reality, which is the foundation of the world and the vehicle through which the world was created. And the judge must transcend the world and plug into that which is prior to the world. And must do what is right in the eyes of God and not what is right in the eyes of man. Right? That's a leader. A true leader representative of the Jewish people is really the representative of God. The leader doesn't represent the people and therefore must answer to the people. The leader must represent God and answer to God. And in representing God is the way that he ultimately will represent the people in a way that the world will be founded. So therefore the judge and the Kohen are really in close proximity. Right? Really in close proximity. So now, why is the first case that's presented after the appointment of a judge the case of judgment of idol practice? Because it's the acid test of a Jewish judge. It's the acid test of a Jewish judge. Because from a secular justice point of view, justice as understood as after world, serving world, for human survival, what do you care if this guy bows down to the sun? Right? I mean, within the context of the concern for human survival, what do you care? You don't care, right? Is he hurting anybody? No. And therefore, what are you doing? In fact, it seems unjust to bring to trial and possibly capital punishment an idol worshiper because you are undermining human survival, which justice must answer to, right? From that perspective, the acid test of a Jewish judge is the realization that idolatry undermines the foundation of the world. Because it undermines the relationship with God and the testimony that there is a God and a godly justice. A justice which is the will of God rather than the perception of man. Therefore, the idol worshiper and the case of idol worship is the acid test. It is that very clear case that differentiates between divine justice and human justice. Right? A Jewish judge and a merely secular judge. Justice as it is seen as human survival, serving the needs of human survival, or justice as a divine attribute that the world must serve, and in its service is the only way that it could be founded and have any real reality to it. Right? Do you see? And therefore that is really the case that's brought first. It's a very interesting Gemara in Gittin that says that a Jew should not go to a non-Jewish court or a court of idol worshippers, even if those idol worshippers have the same laws as you. Even if the judge will come up with the same verdict as a Jew. Why? Because you're giving value to idolatry. Now what's the difference? If it's the same law and the same verdict, what's the difference? There's a big difference. Because the law of the idol worshipper is the human device manipulating reality to serve their needs and their survival. And the Jewish justice is the divine will, right, which man is subservient to, and human survival is subservient to. And therefore it's not the same. It might read the same, look the same. It's not the same. It's not the same. One is justice after creation, the human device. The other is justice before creation, the divine will. Completely different justice. Right? Completely different justice. And the acid test is the idol worshipper. Precisely the idol worshipper. Who doesn't seem to be doing anything wrong other than undermining the very principles upon which the world is founded. A relationship with one God. One creator. And in the context of Jewish justice, that is wrong. Because that's what Jewish justice is all about. Right? Okay, so now let's go into the specifics. Right? What is the specifics over here? We have six statements made to the judge. Right? Three that are clearly related to his position as a judge, and three that are not clearly related to the position of the judge. The Sephorno gives a very beautiful answer. He says, all these are examples of what looks externally right to us, but is still wrong. Like, what's wrong with a beautiful tree next to the Mizbeach? You know, it like kind of like adds to the interior decor. Why not? Right? And although from our perspective it might look aesthetically beautiful, it might look like it's good, it's not. Right? Because justice is not a function of human perception, justice is a function of divine will. And human perception, as we learned yesterday, is to understand divine will. Right? Not to understand human perception. And what about a matseva? A single block. I mean, in one period of time was okay. Right? So in essence, it doesn't seem to be anything wrong with it. It was just used for idolatrous practices. So what's wrong with it? Right? What's wrong with it is God said no. Right? Externally to your human perceptions, it doesn't seem like there would be anything wrong with that. And yet there's something wrong with that. And so too an animal with blemish. An animal with a blemish. I mean, from your perspective, this is a very fat, you know, very expensive, valuable animal on the market. And even though this particular cut, defined by Torah as a blemish, has absolutely no bearing on the market, wouldn't devaluate it a penny, right? It's worthless in the eyes of God. Although in the eyes of man, it's worth $1,000. Right? Therefore, the judge must appreciate that his judgment is not based on human perspective. The judge must be a vehicle for bringing into the world divine will. And that's what a judge is all about. Right? That's what a judge is all about. He has to be this holy servant of God who uses his mind in complete subservience to God's will and not human perspective. And then his mind becomes a sanctuary for the divine will. And he becomes a living mouthpiece for God's justice. And therefore, it's very connected. Right? It's very connected. The relationship between the judge and the Kohen is very connected. The court and the Beis HaMikdash, very connected. And the judge is a Kohen in his own way. Right? His court is a Beis HaMikdash. His table, so to speak, right, is like an altar. And his verdict is an offering. Right? And he has to understand that. Because he realizes his position is one that serves God. The primordial divine ideals and values upon which the world is founded and is not to serve man. Right? He is serving man, of course, through serving God. It's the only authentic way to serve man. Even though human perception says X, divine will says Y. And it's divine will upon which human survival will indeed succeed. And therefore, maybe from our point of view, what do I care? I could tolerate some guy living next door to me that bows down to the sun every day. What do I care? Right? What is it doing to human survival? It is undermining the foundations of the world. That there is one God, and there is a relation between man and God, and it's to God that we must be subservient. And in only that way do we create a foundation for existence. Okay? So therefore, Shoftim is the next step in building Am Yisrael. Alright, we're coming to the land. We have to understand the basic faith context of Torah and land and Torah. But then in terms of the first, now that we've set the philosophical emunah foundations of how we will build the community, what's the first steps in building the community? The first step is when you get into Eretz Israel, right, you got to get rid of the idol worshipping. Right? And then the second step is to build the leaders, right, that will create the context of a Jewish state which has absolutely no influence or implications of the philosophies of idolatry. Okay? And therefore, Shoftim is the next position. The leaders. Who are the leaders? Right? Who are the leaders? And what are their responsibilities?
Is the non-Jewish court inherently parallel to idolatry because it deals with after creation justice? It created the justice system.
Well, it's a problem. I mean, you see, you have to understand that As difficult as it is to say a person who doesn't give charity is like an idolater, right? So too, to a certain extent, when you understand the word idolatry in a much deeper way, which is like, you have to understand in a much deeper way, right? In a deeper way, it represents a philosophy of reality, a perspective on existence. That's what it means. It doesn't mean just bowing down to some rock, right? Bowing down to rock is simply a symptom of that philosophy. And therefore, you know, a court which is not concerned with God and is not based on revealed truth, right, is a problem.
But what about the American court? They think God will trust
what's
the revealed
truth. Well, you have to also understand that they still have a sense of Torah, and they themselves, the Constitution, much of it was based on the Decalogue, and the early settlers of the United States really considered themselves continuing the mission of the Jews, right? I was just doing research on this. The president of the first elected president of Harvard University, in his election speech, said that I consider the Jewish government, when seen from a merely civil point of view, as a perfect republic. And therefore, they had a consciousness of the Jews and the example of the Jews. And the Jews are, in a funny way, the models of what United States of America wanted to build its society upon. Right, that's what it wanted, and those early settlers saw themselves as continuing the mission of Judaism, of course, with the, you know, addition of a New Testament. But even so, we can't minimize the effects that Judaism has had on you know, society, and specifically Western civilization, and specifically the United States of America. Right, so they are trying to do it in a God consciousness. That's the question, though. Can we rely on these judges? Is their court, right, juxtaposed to their Kohen? Or can a judge not believe in God and be a good judge? Sure. I mean, when you go for, when you get your degree in law, is one of the questions on the application, do you believe in God? I don't think so. Right? Are you devoted to an absolute truth? No. So therefore, it's a problem, no? Right? You go to a judge or a lawyer who doesn't believe in God, who doesn't believe that the world is created, therefore what do they see themselves as? They see themselves in a position to maintain human survival. And therefore, if your concern is to maintain human survival, then that will indicate various laws that will contradict Torah, contradict a godly law. I mean, from the point of view of human survival, homosexuality, I mean, before, I mean, now, well, you know, they get into AIDS and this and that, so, you know, you might try to build some kind of very weak case. But ultimately, everyone's got the right to do what they want to do. And if they want to go to a gay bar, what's it your business? Right? What's it your business? From a human survival point of view, if that's the criteria of justice, then you're right. It's not my business. Right? But if you see justice as not after creation, serving the needs of man as he so perceives it, but before creation, serving the ideals of God, right? Well, then it's against the ideals of God. And therefore, it undermines humanity, because what is the definition of humanity? The definition of humanity is not just to survive, because for that God doesn't create a world. The definition of humanity is to reach the level of being a manifestation of godliness.
For man.
What?
For man. In order for man to reach
him. Of course. Right? But it's not a human ideal that he came up with. It's a divine ideal, and a divine ideal then determines how we reach that. And therefore, idolatry and homosexuality and all these various acts, which in, you know, a liberalistic point of view of justice, big deal. Am I hurting anybody? Right? You see, when you look at the world from a point of view, I'm not hurting anybody. We didn't come into this world not to hurt anybody. That was taken for granted. Right? That was taken for granted. I think many animals have that consciousness of not hurting each other. You know, animals have a certain moral code from that point of view too. Right? We didn't come to this world not to hurt anybody. We came in this world to love everybody. Right? And to create a world which is founded upon real relationships and real love. Right? A world that is a manifestation of the non-duality of divinity. That's what we came into this world to do. Right? And therefore, anything that undermines that is unjust. Right? That's the difference. Right? That's the difference. That's what's frightening about our present world and the state of our present world. Because is justice justice? When you have a judge that might not even believe in God. Or when you go to a hospital and you hear the head of the hospital, which really put me off, when in the hospital, and one of the heads of the hospital is basically telling you about the theory of evolution. And he felt it almost his responsibility to let you know that he believes in the theory of evolution, not as a divine process, but as a process of natural selection and accident. And like, you know, let's face it, and from just the pragmatic point of view, whether there's a God or not, from the pragmatic point of view, right, a judge that doesn't believe in God, right, a transcendent being that he must answer to, right, a judge or a lawyer that doesn't believe in God, a doctor who doesn't believe in God, a businessman, let's face it, from just a purely pragmatic point of view, why would you expect them to be honest, right? Their honesty will be to the extent of, right, as long as it works, right, as long as it works. Unless they are still under the influence of monotheism, although they say in words they don't believe in God, their behavior and their consciousness is still governed by God, and therefore we're still riding the waves of the consciousness of God, right? That's the only reason we still exist, right, because all those atheists are still ethical monotheists in disguise. But the problem is that as that goes off, once they've pulled the rug out of the foundation of those principles, they like the principles, they just don't think the foundations are important, then the principles are obviously slowly deteriorating too. And therefore, yeah, sure, every person will be, well, they're still very honest lawyers and they don't believe in God, they're still very honest doctors and they don't believe in God. They don't consciously believe in God, but they still unconsciously believe in God. But they are just a generation away from the next generation that will unconsciously not believe in God. Right?
Subconsciously.
Right? Subconsciously, right. Not only consciously not believe in God, but also subconsciously. I mean, right now there are plenty of honest people because I believe they subconsciously believe in God, even though they don't consciously want to admit that. But what about the next generation that will not only consciously say they don't believe in God, but really they are so void of any God consciousness that they subconsciously also don't believe in God? That's the generation. And I think we're right in there. We're really right in there. It's not so long ago. Atheism as a cultural manifestation didn't happen too long ago, right? Too long ago. I mean, there was polytheism, but still there's some kind of belief in a transcendent being that maybe you tried to manipulate, but still there's something there that you have to kind of like duck from. But atheism as a cultural manifestation throughout the world, that's not so long ago.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.